So today's recollections are recollection of virtue, recollection of generosity, recollection of deities, and then the next chapter, mindfulness of death, or recollection of death. So recollection of virtue. One who wants to develop the recollection of virtue should go into solitary retreat and recollect his own different kinds of virtue in their special qualities of being untorn, etc., as follows. In the teachings of the Buddha, the virtue or moral conduct is much emphasized, and the adherents are instructed or advised to keep these precepts very pure. So it is said that they should be untorn, unrent, unblotched, unmottled, and that they should be liberating, praiseworthy, wise, not adhered to, and conducive to concentration. They are described. Whenever a good sila is described, Buddha used these words. And the commentaries, including the path of purification, explained how the sila or the precepts are untorn, unrent, unblotched, and unmottled. So for lay devotees, Buddha prescribed five precepts, and these are called precepts of a lay devotee, and not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no telling lies, and no intoxicants. And these five precepts are called householder's precepts, or sometimes they are called nitya sila, permanent precepts. That means to be kept always by the devotees, or by those who take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And since utmost purity is important, here the Buddha said they must be untorn, unrent, and so on. Now, what is a torn virtue or torn sila? Rented sila, blotched sila, mottled sila. So in order to understand, you can read the paragraph 102. Now, please have in mind, just these precepts, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, if number one is broken, then the virtue is called torn virtue. Or if number five is broken, it is called torn. But if number two is broken, or number three is broken, or if number four is broken, then it is called rent. If they are not broken like that, it is called unrented. So there is a little difference between these words. But in reality, the precepts are to be kept intact.
So killing and intoxication are actually, in a sense, more serious, the first and the fifth.
Oh, not that way. Because here the commentary is explaining the untorn, unrent, unblotched, and unmottled, how they are different when they are described in that way. So if number one is broken, or number five is broken, it is called torn. But if number two or number three or number four is broken, then it is rent. And if number one and two, or one, two, and three, or two and three, or two, three, and four are broken, then they are called blotched. And then if number one and three are broken, or two and four are broken, every other precept, then it is called mottled.
simultaneously broken, just talk about breaking precepts.
Maybe not simultaneously, but on one occasion, or maybe in a day. And in general, they are untorn, unrent, unblotched, unmodeled. When they are undamaged by the seven bonds of sexuality, and they are described in chapter 1, paragraph 144. And in Burma, they are called minor sex or something like that. Not actually indulging in sexual act, but taking delight in looking at pleasurable, looking at beautiful things, taking delight in listening to the voice or sound of one who, whom you love, and so on. So they are called small or minor sexual acts. So they are here called seven bonds of sexuality. And then they are not to be damaged by anger and enmity and the other evil things. And the virtue should be liberating. They liberate by freeing from the slavery of craving. That means when you practice sila, you practice sila for sila's sake and not for the sake of something, not to get results and so on. And they are praised by the wise, because they are praised by such wise men as enlightened ones, because they are praised by Buddha and others. And they are not adhered to. Adhered to here means they are not kept motivated by craving or other unwholesome mental states like wrong view. And because of the impossibility of misapprehending that there is this flaw in your virtues, that means not really misapprehending, but impossibility of being accused or being criticized that there is this flaw in your virtue. they keep their sila so pure, so flawless, that nobody can say there is a flaw here, there is a flaw there. So it is not actually misapprehending. And the word, the Pali word there is given here, paramattham. Now, this word, sometimes the word derived from the same root, the word paramasa, is used in suttas. And paramasa means something like wrong view. Paramasa, the literal meaning of paramasa is to what do you call this? To rub, something like that.
To stroke.
To stroke or to rub. And so it can also mean to take hold of. And mostly it is used for a wrong taking hold, I mean wrong view. But in the later explanation, the beginning with all, because of the impossibility of misapprehending, here, the Pali word paramattham means to accuse or to be accused, to be found fault with. So not misapprehending here. There is this flaw in your virtue. They are conducive to concentration, since they conduce to excess concentration and absorption concentration, or to path concentration and fruition concentration. So that is why pure moral conduct is important, especially when we practice meditation. Because when we practice meditation, we try to get concentration. Because without concentration, without unification of mind or stillness of mind, we cannot hope to see the real thing, or we cannot hope to penetrate into the nature of things. So in order to be able to penetrate into the nature of things, we need samadhi, we need unification of mind. And in order to get unification of mind or concentration of mind, we need what conduces to concentration, which is sila or virtue. So the virtue well kept is conducive to concentration. Because when we keep our precepts, we do not have any guilt feelings, we do not have any remorse. Say if I have broken a rule and I think about it again and again, then this remorse comes to me again and again, especially when I practice meditation. Say I'm expected to be very pure, and now I've done something wrong, and so on. So when this thought of guilt comes to us again and again, we cannot hope to get stillness of mind, peacefulness of mind. So that is why the pure virtue or moral conduct is important, especially when we practice meditation. Now here, the Buddha's disciple kept those precepts untorn, unrent, and so on. As long as he recollects his own virtues and their special qualities of being untorn, etc., in this way, then on that occasion his mind is not obsessed by greed and so on. So when he recollects on his purity of sila, purity of virtue, there can be no greed in his mind, no anger or hatred in his mind, there can be no delusion in his mind. And so his mind has rectitude, that means what we call straightness, on that occasion being inspired by virtue. So when he has suppressed the hindrances in the way already described, the jhana factors arise in a single conscious moment. That means at one moment, the jhana factors arise. That means they become stronger, they become more matured, because jhana factors are always with us when we practice meditation, the initial application of mind, a sustained application of mind, and so on. So we experience these jhana factors from time to time, some of them from time to time, and the first and the second factors almost always. But they become stronger and stronger as you progress. And so at one time they become very, very strong. But since since owing to the profundity of the virtue's special qualities, or owing to his being occupied in recollecting special qualities of many sorts, the jhana has only access and does not reach absorption. So one cannot reach real jhana through this practice of meditation. The jhana here is the neighborhood concentration, actually, not the real jhana. But the initial application and so on are called jhana factors, whether they arise with the jhana consciousness or arise with other types of consciousness. So that is why they are here called jhana factors. But we are not to take that this means the real jhana, because the real jhana cannot be obtained through the practice of these recollection meditations, simply because the object is profound, and also when you are thinking of many things, you do not get real strong concentration. Not like say breathing meditation or other kinds of meditation, where you put your mind on one object only and keep it there as long as you can. But here you are actually recollecting or thinking of many things, so samadhi cannot be too strong here. And that excess jhana itself is known as recollection of virtue too, because it arises with the virtue's special qualities as the means. So sometimes we say recollection of virtue, but actually we mean the concentration. We mean the excess jhana, that means neighborhood concentration. And when a bhikkhu is devoted to this recollection of virtue, he has respect for the training as a monk. He lives in communion with his fellows in the life of purity. He is sedulous in welcoming. He is devoid of the fear of self-reproach and so on. Fear here really means danger of self-reproach. When one's moral conduct is not pure, and there are five dangers: self-reproach, reproach of others, punishment, let me see, punishment, and then unhappy destiny. One more, right? There must be five. Self-reproach and reproach of others, and then punishment, and then unhappy destiny. One more. I couldn't remember it. It will come later. So these are the benefits of the practice of recollection and meditation. Next is recollection of generosity, that is one's own generosity. So who wants to develop the recollection of generosity should be naturally devoted to generosity and the constant practice of giving and sharing. Or alternatively, if he is one who is studying the development of it, he should make the resolution: from now on, when there is anyone present to receive, I shall not eat even a single mouthful without having given a gift. So without having given some portion of his food, say he will not eat, something like that. And that very day he should give a gift by sharing according to his means and his ability with those who have distinguished qualities, that means who are virtuous. When he has apprehended the sign in that means in giving, that means when he has taken into his mind or put his mind on the act of giving, he should go into solitary retreat and collect his own generosity in its special qualities of being free from stain of avarice, etc., as follows: it is great gain for me that in a generation obsessed by the stain of avarice, I abide with my heart free from stain and avarice, and am freely generous and open-handed, that I delight in relinquishing, expect to be asked, and rejoice in giving and sharing. This is how you practice the recollection of generosity. It is a gain for me, that means it is an advantage. I surely partake of those kinds of gain for a giver that has been recommended by the Blessed One as follows. The Buddha often talked about the benefits of giving. So if I practice generosity, I will get these advantages. A man who gives life by giving food shall have life either divine or human. In one sutta, Buddha said, a person who offers food actually offers five things: life, beauty, happiness, strength, and intelligence. Because if you don't have to eat, you will die, and so on. So in fact, by giving food, a person gives these five things, and since he gives these five things, he will get results in being having a long life in his next life, and having happiness and so on. And then a giver is loved and frequented by many. So a donor is loved and many people want to approach him. One who gives is ever loved according to the wise man's laws. In fact, what is meant here is a person who gets into the wise man's practice. Law here means just practice. You know, the word Dhamma is very difficult. If you stick to only one translation, you will miss the point. So every time you find the word Dhamma, you have to be discriminating, say which kind of Dhamma it is meant. So we cannot translate the word Dhamma as by the word law always. Sometimes it means law, and sometimes it means practice, sometimes it means wholesome states and unwholesome states and so on. So here, one who gives is ever loved, because he gets into the practice of wise men. It is great for me, and obsessed by the stain of avarice. That means people are stingy, and so among these people who are stingy, I am not stingy. I practice generosity and so on. And generation means beings, so called owing to the fact of their being generated. Now, the Pali word is paja, paja, and Nyanamoli always translates paja as generation. Paja is the Pali word paja is a synonym for satta, a being. So bhaja means just being. But in Pali it is used in singular number, although it means many people. I think like the English word people or a group. I don't know what people understand by the word generation. If you say generation, do you understand it to mean the whole, or all beings, or
generation has several meanings in itself. It has giving birth, it's being generated.
Yeah.
It sometimes means when we say people of a generation, that means of a 10-year span. Everybody, that's called a generation.
Yeah. Yes.
It also has a time measurement. Generation is.
It has to be for
20.
The
reproduction
of the next
right.
generation.
So I'm afraid that people might take that to mean, say, one generation, two generation of mankind, and so on. But here, the generation, or the Pali word paja, means simply beings. So we can translate it as people or beings. Generation beings. So the meaning here is this: among beings, no, he used beings. Among beings who are overwhelmed by the stain of avarice, which is one of the dark states, that means unwholesome states, that corrupt the natural transparency of consciousness, and which has the characteristic inability to bear sharing one's own good fortune with others. So avarice is intolerance of one's own good being shared by others. That means I have this book. I cannot bear to share this book with other person. If other person comes and uses this book, I don't like it. And that is what is called avarice in Pali, in Abhidhamma. It is not really stinginess. There is a very subtle difference, because the Pali word machariya is translated here as avarice. And machariya is accompanied by dosa. anger, not by lobha. So stinginess means, what is stinginess? You don't want to give your thing to other persons. You are attached to it. So it may be caused by attachment, but it does not accompany attachment, the macharya. So macharya, when there is macharya, there is something like upset, being upset. I don't like my things to be used by others.
Or a particular person. It might be anger that's generating it, not greed so much.
And as a monk, say we depend on people. So I don't want my sabuddha to become the sabuddha of other monk, something like that. That is also macharya in Pali.
Possessiveness?
Something like that, yeah. And then say I have a degree. Then I don't want others to get degrees. That's also macharya. May this success happen only to me and not to others. Something like that. That is translated as avarice here. And then the commentator brings in the sutta. And in the sutta, Buddha said, I live the home life with my heart free. That is in response to a householder asking Buddha, say, what to do, what kind of abiding he has to keep. That's why he says, Buddha says, live the home life. So it is not meant for, that sentence is not meant for monks, because monks live homeless life. So the commentator is here explaining just that. Buddha said, live home life in this sutta, because he was talking to a lay person and not to monks. So for monks, Buddha say, for monks, the commentator just say he lives, not live the homely, what's it called? Not live the home life, but just lives. And then at the end of that paragraph, there the meaning is, I live overcoming. I think it should be overcoming. Say you are the head of a family. So you live governing the family, or being the leader of the family. That is what is meant in Pali here. Overpowering?
Supporting?
Not supporting, but you are above the family, something like that.
Leading?
Leading, yeah. Leading. Overseeing. And then... paragraph 112, say about 6-7 lines down, we have the certain yaja yoga is a reading, in which case the meaning is devoted, yoga to, and so on. Now, yaja yoga is another reading, not a reading, it is another reading. Sometimes we have different readings. Since they are carried down by word of mouth and also by writing, we have some variant readings.
Uh-huh.
So this is another reading of the word, Pali word, yaja yoga. And so if the reading is with J instead of C, then the meaning is a little different, because yaja with J means sacrificing. Here, sacrificing means just giving. So actually it means the same thing. And rejoicing, sharing, and so on. So the others are not difficult to understand. This meditation also lead to only excess concentration and not to jhana, real jhana concentration. Then the recollection of deities. Now, in the recollection of deities, there are given different realms, and they are what we call the six realms of devas. The first is the realm of the four kings. That is the first realm. The second is the Dāvatīṃsa, the realm of the 33. And the next is Yama, deities who are gone to divine bliss. And the next is Tusita, the deities who are contented. And next is Nimmanarati, those who delight in creating things for themselves and enjoy them. Then next is Paranimittavasavati, who wield power over others' creations. Actually, they do not create things for themselves, but they have other deities create things for them and enjoy them. So the difference between the two is the Nimmanarati, the first ones, create things for themselves for their enjoyment. But the next one are maybe more lazy. they don't create things for themselves, but they have others create for them. like people nowadays. People don't want to do things, but they have other people make things for them, and then they use them. And there are deities of Brahma's retinue. That means they are higher celestial beings, Brahma. And there are deities higher than that. You know, there are Brahmas of the first plane, second plane, third plane, and fourth plane. So at least there are fourth planes of the Brahmas. And all those deities possess faith such as that on dying here, they were reborn there, and such faith is present in me too. Actually, this recollection is recollection of one's own qualities, actually. But comparing one's own qualities with the qualities the deities have. So these people, these beings are reborn. Before they are reborn as deities, they were human beings, and when they were human beings, they have such qualities as faith, and then what? Virtue, learning, generosity, and understanding and panya. And these qualities are in me too, something like that. And here also, there is a kind of discrepancy between what the commentaries say and what is said in the text. But the commentaries here arbitrarily said, this is what is meant. when Buddha taught to Mahānama, actually Mahānama is was his cousin. So when Buddha taught to Mahānama, Buddha said, "A noble disciple recollects the faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and the understanding that are both his own and those deities." So if we take that literally, then it means that you must recollect on the qualities of the deities and then on the qualities in yourself. So you must reflect on both qualities of both yourself and the deities. But the commentary said that it is important that you just take the qualities of the deities as an example, but actually what you must do is dwell on the qualities of yourself. So these qualities, those who possess these qualities are reborn as devas and brahmas, and those qualities are in me, and so I will also be reborn there or something like that. So he recollects his own special qualities, making the deities stand as witnesses. That means just taking them as an as example.
For at least this Western person, this is quite a bit different than, even with the change you just said, quite different than recollecting the three treasures and generosity and virtue. Those are can easily see how they would be very efficacious and very useful objects of meditation.
Mm.
But deities or gods, in other places, Buddha says the question of whether they're gods or not does not further, of whether they're existent or not does not further one. That's not one of the useful questions or decisions. And yet, this is as an object of, as one of the six, it seems a little out of place.
According to the text, then there are different kinds of persons, beings, say human beings, and lower than them animals, and beings in hell, and beings in celestial realms also. So here we recollect on our own good qualities, actually, not on their qualities, but these qualities, they had these qualities and they are reborn there, and so these qualities are in me too, and so you dwell on your own good qualities.
So another way of saying it would be dwelling on the highest qualities that you perceive, whether they be deities or in yourself. That would be an object of meditation.
But here, dwelling on one's own qualities, because if you dwell on the other's qualities, then it may be something like a recollection of the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Sangha. But here, just as you dwell on your own virtue, sila. So they all refer to oneself.
So it's like the recollection of virtue.
Recollection of virtue, recollection of generosity, and this one. So first you may dwell a little on the qualities of the devas, and then principally you dwell on your own qualities. And here also you cannot get jhana concentration. Just the access or neighborhood concentration. And then in the general statements, on page 245, first lines of the law makes him glad. When he is glad, happiness is born in him. And herein, the meaning inspires him should be understood as said of contentment inspired by the meaning beginning this blessed one is such since he is, and so on. Now, contentment is not a good translation for the Pali word dukkhi here. In the Mangala Sutra, there's a word santukti, and that is contentment. Santukti. Now here there is no sun, just dukti. And dukti is explained in the commentary as something like happiness. So here what is meant is the pleasure or joy inspired by the meaning. Not contentment. And the law inspires him is said of contentment inspired by the text. Here also, the joy inspired by the text. The application of the law makes him glad is said of both. Here I think we should say he gets joy connected with Dhamma. Not the application of the law makes him glad. Actually, when he practices the collection meditation, he becomes joyful. He thinks of the words themselves, and he thinks of the meaning of the words, And whether he keeps his mind on the words or the meanings, he gets joy from recollection of this. And that joy is connected with the practice, connected with Dhamma. So the last one is to be translated not as the application of the law makes him glad. Something like he gets satisfaction or he gets joy connected with Dhamma. You can get happiness or joy by going after worldly pleasures. But here the joy you get is from the practice of meditation.
So we can say the application of the law is joyful?
Application of the law is joyful. The
practice is better.
If we translate Pali literally, we should say he gets joy depending on the meaning. He gets joy depending on the text. He gets joy which is connected with Dhamma or practice. And then the commentary said that these recollections can be practiced to perfection only by those who have gained enlightenment. Those who have not yet gained enlightenment can practice these recollections, but they cannot practice to the highest level of perfection. And the different suttas are quoted here. So that is the last paragraph. The Venerable One, it seems, let me see. Still, though this is so, they can be brought to mind by an ordinary man too. Ordinary man means those who have not yet enlightened man, if he possesses the special qualities of purified Vajra and the rest. For when he is recollecting the special qualities of the Buddha, etc., even only according to hearsay, that means the second-hand knowledge, his consciousness settles down, in virtue of which the hindrances are suppressed. In his supreme gladness, he initiates insight, and he even attains to arahantship, like the elder Pusadeva, who dwelt at Katakandakara, is the name of a place. The Venerable One, it seems, saw a figure of the Enlightened One created by Mara. You know, in Buddhism there is Mara, which is like Satan in Christianity. So sometimes Mara is considered to be a person, but many people think that it is personified the unwholesome state. But here it is taken as a person. So this monk met the Mara, and then this monk was very devoted to the Buddha, although he was not born at the time of the Buddha. So he wanted to see the Buddha. He wanted to see the likeness of the Buddha. And Mara was alive when Buddha was living, and so he asked Mara to assume the form of a Buddha, form of the Buddha, so that he could look at him. So the Mara assumed the form of the Buddha. So looking at the form of the Buddha, he thought, how good this appears despite its having greed, hate and delusion. That means this Mara has greed, hatred and delusion in him. Even then, when he assumes the form of the Buddha, it's very, very beautiful or very inspiring. And what can the Blessed One's goodness have been like? So the real Buddha, the real appearance of the Buddha might be thousands of times better than this. For he was quite without greed, hate and delusion. He acquired happiness with the Blessed One as object, and by augmenting his insight, that means developing his vipassana, he reached arahantship. So, after practicing recollection meditations, one can go over or change to vipassana and practice vipassana meditation. So vipassana meditation is trying to see the impermanence, suffering and soullessness of things. And so it can take any state, anything as an object. Sometimes they just take the joy they got from the recollection. So they look upon joy as impermanent and so on, and practice vipassana meditation and develop it and to get enlightenment. Now the next one, mindfulness of death. Now death is defined here as the interruption of the life faculty included within the limits of a single becoming or single existence. That means one life, a human life or an animal life or whatever. And interruption really means cessation or being cut off. So stoppage or cessation of the life faculty. You know life faculty, jivita in Pali. Something which keeps our bodies alive, and that is called life faculty. And also there is life faculty of mind. So there are two life faculties, physical